It is my great pleasure and honor to introduce Professor Samuel Heilman, who holds the Harold Prashansky Chair in Jewish Studies at the Graduate Center and is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at Queens College of the City University of New York. He has also been a visiting professor at a dozen or so universities, including the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv University, and the universities of New South Wales and Melbourne in Australia. He is the author of numerous articles and reviews, as well as 9 books. I still remember when I read Professor Heilman's first book, Synagogue Life, shortly after its publication. It was not long after I had studied a number of sociology courses as an undergraduate, and I was fascinated to see the insights of a trained and skilled sociologist being applied to shul behavior, or lack of behavior, if you prefer. Since that book came out in 1976, there's been a tremendous growth in the field of Jewish sociology. But Professor Heilman should be recognized as one of the pioneering founders of this field, and he is still one of its leaders 30 years later. I will not mention all of the awards that he has received. I want to leave him some time to speak. But I will tell you that in 2004, he won the Marshall Sclair Memorial Award for his lifetime of scholarship from the Association for the Social Scientific Study of Jewry. I didn't ask Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Malamed, but my guess is that there are 2 books in particular that Professor Heilman wrote that elicited the invitation to speak here. One of them is about us, Cosmopolitans and Parochials, Modern Orthodox Jews in America. I've always wanted to be called cosmopolitan. And of course, there is his most recent book, Sliding to the Right, The Contest for the Future of American Jewish Orthodoxy. Professor Heilman's work has been reviewed glowingly. Recently, Barbara Kirshenblatt-Gimblett wrote, Heilman is one of the most productive, interesting, and important sociologists writing about Jewish communities in the world today. He is a first-rate thinker, an excellent researcher whose work is richly empirical, and an unusually clear and lively writer. And I would add, he is also a gifted speaker. Professor Heilman will speak today on the topic of sliding to the right, the shift in contemporary orthodoxy. Professor Heilman.
Thank you very much. It's really very nice of you to say all of those things about me. I'm sure there are people here who would say other things as well. on a blog, yes. Thank you. What I want to do today is to talk briefly about something that I'm sure is familiar to many of you, if not all of you in this audience, which is what I call in my most recent book, The Contest for the Future of American, I suppose here I should say North American Jewish Orthodoxy. And that is the tension that exists between two trends, generally two trends in the Orthodox world. These are trends that in some ways seem like they are at two ends of a spectrum, but I think those of you, for example, who were at the previous session that Rabbi Gil's student gave, saw that sometimes the lines are blurred, that someone can call himself, he referred to himself as living on the moderate Haredi fringe. So clearly there is in this spectrum of possibilities, a whole variety of places along the road. Maybe, though, we should start with some kind of general, even though looking around the audience, I'm not sure that that is necessary, but some kind of general overview of what is understood by orthodoxy, what do we mean by orthodoxy, or sometimes the term that we use more colloquially, what do we mean by frum? And I have to say that in some senses, there was a lot of question between my publisher and myself as to what we should call this book. And one of the possibilities was Frum and Frummer. But he was afraid that people in the rest of the world might not know what that was talking to, and that the resonances of Frum and Frummer and Dumb and Dumber were just too much for the book to bear. In any event, I would say that Orthodox Jews, who number only about 12% of the American Jewish population, and these are the ones that we're really concerned with, these are people for whom Judaism is not simply and not primarily a personal matter. On the contrary, for Orthodox Jews, Judaism is made up of a series of mandates, commandments, requirements, whose origins are considered part of a venerated tradition, and that sets definite criteria for how one should live, what one should believe, how one must act, regardless of personal wishes or inclinations. There is a sense in Orthodoxy that you don't necessarily make your own mind up, that there are authorities, there are limits, or as Rabbi Studen put it, there are red lines that shouldn't be crossed. This is a life with people who are rooted in Jewish obligations, who have come to call themselves, in some cases, a term that was more popular in the past, Torah true Jews, or who practice what they call a Torah true Judaism, a Judaism that is linked somehow inextricably to a way of life that is defined more or less by halakha, and in common parlance, as I said, is referred to as frum. Now, what exactly that includes is, of course, some matter of debate. Does it allow for personal autonomy? Does it not allow for personal autonomy? Does it demand an engagement with the world outside? Does it not demand an engagement with the world outside? And in a sense, some of the debate that goes on, both in terms of behavior and in terms of outlook, is really about the question of how to properly define orthodoxy, and also the secondary question, which is very difficult to separate from the first one, is what is the best recipe for guaranteeing a future to orthodoxy? And that question of the survival of orthodoxy, or what can guarantee the future, is undoubtedly, as I've argued in this book, connected in some way to the fact that many Orthodox Jews in America are really the products of a post-Shoah, post-Holocaust immigration to America. Without going into the history of American Orthodoxy, we know that much of the Orthodoxy that exists in North America is the result of Jews who came either on the eve of the Second World War or who came after it. Not that there wasn't Orthodoxy here before, but the genuine energy of American Orthodoxy is a post-Holocaust phenomenon, and there's no question that the experience of being a survivor or a child of survivor or now a grandchild of survivors brings with it some notion not only of survivor guilt, but what can one best do in order to assure the future of Orthodoxy. So the debate within Orthodoxy is really twofold. One is, what is the best way, what is the truest way of being Orthodox? And connected to that is the question of, is this way of being Orthodox, will it guarantee survival, which is, after all, a solemn moral responsibility, given the fact of how many Orthodox Jews, how much of Orthodox Jewry was decimated during the Shoah. And I don't mean to suggest that Orthodox Jews that more Orthodox Jews were decimated in the Shoah than other. Every kind of Jew was attacked during the Shoah. But we do know that Orthodox Jews were much easier to target. Orthodox Jews had taken many of them the advice of their leaders beforehand, who said, don't go to the Treifa Medina, stay where you are, don't change things. And of course, they, as a population, took a much bigger hit proportionately than perhaps any other single group of Jews. So this question of survival is certainly a part of the debate, and it hangs in the debate. And the question was really answered, and like all sociologists, I'm forced to speak in categories, in some ways to generalize, although in any particular case, you can always say, but I know somebody who doesn't perfectly fit this model, but that's okay. Talking in general terms, we can talk about two approaches to Orthodoxy that have emerged in the last 50, 60 years since the resurgence, or if you will, the real rebirth of Orthodoxy in America, and that is engagement with the outside world. On the one hand, there are those Jews, and I called them in the book that Mr. Lukshin referred to before as cosmopolitans and parochials. I once called them cosmopolitans. always looking for a term that can somehow capture the essence of this community. So in the current book, I came up with a term that the anthropologist Mary Douglas used, and it is a term that she actually borrowed from music, but in some ways it seemed to me to capture even better the character of this orthodoxy, and I called it contrapuntalist. What is the contrapuntalist model? And contrapuntal music, you know, is music that goes on at sort of different levels. It's not always perfectly harmonic. It has, it's music that goes on in a lot of different ways. And the contrapuntalist model, which is a pluralist model, competing loyalties to potentially rivalrous institutions and cultures is permitted and even encouraged. Meaning, to put it in a more colloquial way, you can be this and you can be that. You can be a little bit of this and you can be a little bit of that. You can live with one foot in one world and you can live with the other foot in another world, even if these worlds are in contradiction in some ways. This is because the people who are contrapuntalist believe that they have much to gain by living in what the sociologist Peter Berger once called plural life worlds. We live in more than one world at once, worlds of meaning, worlds of involvement, worlds of engagement. And in the contrapuntalist model, the other is not viewed as a demon. The other is not viewed as an outcast. The other is not viewed as necessarily dangerous, but that you can taste the outside world. You can go into another set of worlds. You can inhabit these plural life worlds without becoming intoxicated by them. You know, the word intoxicated has all sorts of elements in it. It has toxic, that it's dangerous, and somehow intoxication means that you take the toxins in. The argument in contrapuntalism, which is a kind of dynamic belonging, you can keep switching. You have to, of course, your gyroscope has to be working so that you don't lose your balance when you move from one world to another. But in contrapuntalist or dynamic belonging, people are allowed to belong to multiple institutions and cultures simultaneously. It also, because the person moves across these various boundaries and different ways of living and different ways of thinking about life and different ways of behaving, it obviously frees the individual to make some level of autonomous choice. Now I'm going to do that. Now I'm going to do this. Now I'm going to be here. Now I'm going to be there. It gives autonomy, and it makes autonomy the choice, the personal choice, the personal decisions of the individual. It gives the individual a kind of strength, excuse me, that he might not always have in other kinds of world. So a contrapuntalist Orthodox Jew, a contrapuntalist Orthodox Jew can accept what some might see as the antithesis to Orthodoxy. For example, in Israel, the free-thinking Zionist waving the standard of modern nationalism, as well as the modern liberal Moscow who champions universal humanism. The contrapuntalist Orthodox Jew can attend the university with all of its ideas, many of which might be viewed within the strict traditional lines of Jewish theology as being perhaps heretical. You can learn the new science even while you learn the old Torah. You can learn about dinosaurs and about evolution and about heaven knows what else. And at the same time, you can study the Gemara. And you can live a life that says that we're living in the year 5,700 and so on of the creation and live in both of those worlds and move across those worlds. The contrapuntalist could accept or embrace, for example, the idea of acculturation, that it is not only possible but in some ways appropriate to share in some of the values of the surrounding culture in which Jews have found themselves. Whether in the way people dress, whether in appreciating some of that culture, whether it's classical music or theater or art or reading history or being interested in archaeology or whatever it is, a whole variety of things, that the source of wisdom is not only Jewish wisdom, but wisdom can come from all sorts of sources. That even as the contrapuntalist remains attached to particularistic Jewish identity, I am an Orthodox Jew, I put on tefillin every day, 6 days a week, I wear tzitzis, I eat kosher, I observe Shabbos, etc., etc., even though one is loyal and attached to that particularistic Jewish identity and activities and a particular Jewish community, I can also be a citizen. I can also have a foot in a world that is altogether different, with people who share different values and different ways of life. And not only is it possible, but the contrapuntalist believes it's desirable, that it is good for Judaism and for a Jew who remains steadfast and loyal and attached to all of these particularities to go out into the world to share something of the other cultures, because not only does Judaism have something to offer in those, but that Judaism is sufficiently strong and rooted that you can touch, be contacted by, have a part of this other culture without necessarily becoming intoxicated by it. And of course, this idea of embracing acculturation, of keeping a foot in both worlds, of living a way that requires all kinds of intellectual, moral, and spiritual acrobatics, this idea is not particular to American Orthodox Jewry. It's an idea, for example, it was championed in German Jewry. We all know about Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and that whole, what was sometimes called the Neo or New Orthodox school of life. This is an idea that has had a life almost from the beginnings of what came to be called Orthodoxy. And Orthodoxy, after all, is a modern movement, a reaction in many cases to other kinds of Jewish change. So contrapuntalists accepted the idea of autonomous choices, even as they also accepted the ideas of attachments and unequivocal commitment to a commander with a capital C who gave them halakha, and to its associated rabbinic authorities. The idea of an Orthodox Jew not having a rabbinic authority is a difficult one to bear. But the contrapuntalists, in a sense, have argued, at least on their positive side, that one can have a rabbinic authority for questions of halakha and of Jewish observance and of Jewish moral questions, but that on other matters, one can be, to use the language of Judaism, you can be your own posek. That there are certain things that you can decide on your own. And certain decisions, you don't ask your rabbi, should I go to see Tosca or not? You might say, well, during the Omer, should I go to see Tosca or not? But the idea of, can I go to the opera or not? Or is theater all right? Or is the university appropriate? Those are decisions that have been made by the contrapuntalists in an autonomous way. They believe in a transcendent and eternal Torah, even if in practical reality, and I think this is an important point to recall, even if in practical reality they don't always fulfill every commandment. So the contrapuntalist who misses mincha doesn't say it's okay to miss mincha. He says, okay, I made an avera, I should have davened mincha that day, but there are other decisions I made. I'm not necessarily celebrating this. In a book that I wrote before this one called Defenders of the Faith, I point out that in a discussion with a Rosh Yeshiva, his argument was, for you, missing mincha is, well, it's an avera. For us, it is a tragedy. Missing mincha is of the highest order, just to give you an illustration. So they read the Bible with faith when it describes the creation of the world, but they also accept scientific explanations that are very hard to always square with the literal text. I'm sure this is not something that is new to this community, given the recent controversy over Zoo Torah. We can say, in a way, that contrapuntalists are not literalists. They see the surrounding world and civilization as a source of positive gratification, even as they feel more comfortable inside their cultural and religious enclaves. Now, on the other side are people that I've called enclavists. Now, what is an enclavist? It is somebody who believes that it is important to remain inside a Jewish enclave, that the outside world is so dangerous, so filled with defilement, that any contact with it, or any contact that at least has moral and ontological value, that has some meaning that is beyond simply instrumental meaning, that's very dangerous. Because if you come in contact with that world, it is going to intoxicate you. It is going to seduce you. It is the step on a slippery slope which will lead to the ultimate assimilation of Jewry. And the ultimate assimilation of Jewry is the ultimate tragedy. The end of the Jewish people, I think we would all agree, certainly within Orthodoxy, the end of Orthodoxy, the end of halachic observance, the end of a distinctive Jewish identity, that is viewed as the ultimate tragedy across the board. The argument that the enclavists make is that only if one remains within the relatively closed community of people who share a common way of life, a common Orthodox Jewish way of life, under the rules of the commander and associated commanders with a small c, only if one lives that life can one ensure the continuity of Judaism. Anything outside that world, and it's pretty near over. One can say that although much of Jewry began in the ghetto, once the ghettos were unlocked, there were those who said, we need to lock the door from the inside. Now that they unlocked it from the outside, we need to unlock it from the inside, because the world out there is going to love us to death. And so the enclavists have argued, if we remain within the enclave, if we remain within our world, there we can ensure the survival of the Jewish people. But living in our world is very difficult in an environment of these plural life worlds, because the modern world seeps in everywhere. You've seen, even in places where they say the internet is forbidden, you can drive down the street and find a wireless in almost every house. The modern world has seeped in, but it must always be pushed out because it is intoxicating, it is dangerous. And so the enclavists have always argued, and increasingly argue more vigorously, that the only way to protect and preserve Orthodoxy, to guarantee survival, is to keep that world at a distance. Keep it as far away as possible. And that means, even when you step out into it, make sure that it is clear that there's a boundary between you and others. If that world is in technicolor, your world will be in black and white. If that world believes that all sorts of wisdom is important, then your world will stress only particular kinds of wisdom is important. So even in the contemporary world, the enclave is the ideal place. At best, this led to living separately, and at worst, it led to a demonizing and sometimes what is called outcasting the other. And one of the characteristics of this enclavist Orthodoxy is it speaks in sort of Manichaean terms, which is, you're with us or you're against us. You're an insider or you're an outsider. You're a good guy or you're a bad guy. You are sensible or you're nuts. You're either saving the Jews or you're undermining the Jewish future. And sometimes the other is not only a source of difference, but as I said, I think the enclavist point of view is the other is ultimately defiling. And you know that the idea of defiling, which comes from religious tradition and even from the whole idea of the korbanot, is that even contact with something the other can be, it can ruin you. You know, you touch something that is tameh and you become tameh. So it assumed defilement by contact with the outside world. And if you have to go to that outside world, you really have to protect yourself with a whole variety of instruments and institutions and supports, because otherwise the risk is that you will lose your sense of separateness and estrangement. And in the enclavist point of view, you should never be too comfortable in the world of the goyim. You should never be too comfortable in the world outside the Arba, the Dalet Amos of the enclave, because if you get too comfortable there, the next thing you know, you'll be marrying them, you'll be like them, you'll disappear. And so there is a fear that the outside world will come into your own. This is, by and large, the fear that many of the Haredi Orthodox express vis-a-vis America. They encourage a consciousness that, in the words of one contemporary Haredi, demand, as he put it, galus hanefesh, a kind of moral and spiritual sense of separateness and estrangement from the contemporary, often enticing, westernized, materialistic world that they believe, and I quote again, devours those who seek to embrace it. So these are, by and large, the two polar opposites, the enclave and the contrapuntal. Now, not all contrapuntalists are alike. You know, we can look at, just as not all enclavists are alike. There are different points on the spectrum. As we said, you can be moderately Haredi, and you can be on the left wing of modern orthodoxy. You can be some who doubt the superiority of the old over the new. You can be ones who try to compartmentalize the two. That is, I live in various worlds, but they shouldn't touch one another. I am camouflaged when I'm in the outside world, and then I reveal myself in the inside world, sort of the Superman Clark Kent kind of Orthodox Jew. Although, you know, with Superman and Clark Kent, I could never figure out why no one could see the similarity between them. Only Clark Kent thought that nobody could recognize him when he put on his glasses. And I think that's true for the Orthodox as well. They're the only ones that think that if you're wearing a baseball hat, nobody will know it's there instead of a yarmulke. It is the same kind of compartmentalization. Yes, there we can talk about all of the ways that we have camouflaged ourselves, including the hats that a lot of women wear when they marry, that somehow are supposed to look as if they're hip, but they're really, they're only the Orthodox wear them. The hip Orthodox, right. So the debate then has been within Orthodoxy, which is the right approach? Is it better to be enclavist or is it better to be contrapuntalist? Is it better to embrace the idea of plural life worlds, or is it better to keep the other worlds at bay and live in a monoculture? Which is the secret for survival? Which is going to be the right answer? And in this debate, of course, the other question, sort of the hidden question, not so hidden in many places, is what should go on within that debate? What should be the nature of the debate? Should it be an honest debate about two different approaches where the combatants can debate in a civilized manner and say, well, I think you're wrong, and I think you're wrong, and here are the reasons? Or does one use the approach that is so often a part of one of these points of view, which is to delegitimate and outcast the other? Or is it necessary to find some common cause? The truth, of course, is that from the outside, from those looking in at the Orthodox world, the distinction between Haredi and modern Orthodox, between contrapuntalist and enclavist, they miss it. They don't see it. They don't recognize those differences in the same way that those on the inside do. So however bitter the debates are on the inside, you should know that from the outside, Orthodox is Orthodox. They don't distinguish. And if a modern Orthodox community, so-called, wants to build a new synagogue in a suburb, the people who oppose it are sure that they're going to see black hats and black coats coming in and telling them, no, we're modern Orthodox. We have a different way of life. It doesn't really register with them in quite the same way. So however bitter the debate is within, you should know that from without, it's not clearly perceived in any event. Now, I've already said that the Holocaust plays a life in all of this debate. It's the background against which this debate takes place. But there have also been a number of things that have happened in the last 30 to 40 years in America that have also changed the nature of the debate. A lot of things. And I'm going to talk about them very telegraphically. First of all, and the reason I'm talking about them telegraphically, and maybe this is a chance to sort of give a pitch, I do the whole argument in here. It's 300 pages. I can't do it in the short time that I have available here. I wanted them to have this book available for people who wanted to read it here, but I guess it's on the Slifkin list. It wasn't available in the bookstore here, but I'm sure you can get it on Amazon.com if you use the internet. If not, you can go to any bookstore, I'm sure, and get a hold of it if you pay in advance, I think, probably here. There have been a series of events in the 20th century that have, in a sense, frightened Orthodoxy. Contrapuntalist Orthodoxy, which believed that it had much to gain, and in particular I'm going to talk about American Orthodoxy, although I think we could say some of these things about Israel as well, about Australia, about European Jewry, et cetera, certainly about Canadian Jewry. Not that Canada isn't part of North America, I understand that. America has changed over the last 30 to 40 years. It's changed in a profound way. It has become much more polarized. America is more liberal today than it's ever been before. We have gay marriage, or at least the possibility of gay marriage. I often say there are only two groups who still want to get married in America, gays and Orthodox Jews. No one else cares about this at all any longer. They're all happy to just live together. It's become more liberal than ever before, and it's become more conservative than ever before. We have a Christian fundamentalist administration in Washington. We have liberals. We have a polarization of America. It's not at all surprising that all our elections are really very close. You know, they're a difference between just a few percentage points. So it is an America which has had the experience of the emptying of the middle. And we all know the middle is a very dangerous place to be. If you walk down the middle of the road, you get hit by the traffic going both directions. It's a very dangerous place to be. And contrapuntalism is precisely a kind of Judaism, a kind of way of life in which one tries to walk down the middle of the street, try to dodge the traffic or move from left to right, or move across the street, move not in a straight line, but like that. Secondly, America, from the point of view of Jewish history, has been going through a period of profound assimilation, intermarriage, and there's been a perceived decline of American culture. American culture has changed in a profound way. And so, in many instances, the Orthodox, who after all, remember, are still Orthodox, no matter where they are in the Orthodox spectrum, they're still Orthodox, which means that they're committed to the continuation, the continuity of Orthodox Judaism, of Halakha, of Torah to Judaism, all of that stuff that is familiar to all of you. They have been frightened, to put it mildly, by these changes in America. At the same time that they have been frightened, chastened by America, and in particular, which part of America was the most frightening to them, it was popular culture. And it was the youth who have been affected most by popular culture, because popular culture in America is a youth phenomenon, you know. After you reach 35, they don't care about you anymore in America in terms of popular culture. So there was a real recoil from popular culture. And in particular, one of the most important institutions for contrapuntalist orthodoxy was the university. In the late 1960s and in the 1970s, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, the radicalization of that world in, ironically, in some of the best universities in America, precisely the universities that so many of the Orthodox wanted their children to go to because they felt that this was the best of what the contemporary world offered, those places became places of profound radicalism, antinomianism, assimilation, ultimately leading to all kinds of questions about whether or not one could continue to live in a world of orthodoxy in that kind of environment. So the perceived decline of American culture, in a sense, gave a chill to the contrapuntalist point of view. At the same time that all of this is happening, the enclave kind of orthodoxy was growing more powerful, growing more self-assured, building institutions, yeshivas, ways of life, having lots of children, and all along sending out the message that their way of life was the only guarantee of an assurance of orthodoxy, and producing a cadre of people who lived 100% within that world, and who more and more became responsible for many of the instrumentalities of Judaism. Just to give you an example, let's say that you're a modern Orthodox Jew, and the issue of Kemach Yoshan doesn't really matter to you that much. Whether you're right or wrong, I don't know, but Kemach Yoshan doesn't matter to you. If you don't know what Kemach Yoshan is, that's okay. It means it doesn't matter to you. It has to do with when the bread was, when the wheat was taken before the Omer, after the Omer, but when that, you can ask elsewhere here, I'm sure. However, you also keep kosher. And keeping kosher means, among other things, that you eat kosher pizza. Because kosher pizza, you're not exactly sure what the problem is with cheese. You heard something about rennet. You don't exactly know how cheese is made. But if there's a pizza and it's a kosher pizza, you're going to eat a kosher pizza. But it turns out that the kosher pizza parlor, in order to be calling itself kosher pizza, has to have a hashgacha from a rabbi. And the rabbi who's giving this hashgacha is no longer a modern Orthodox Jew, because all of those modern Orthodox Jews are now businessmen and professors and whatever. They're not rabbis giving hashgachas. But the rabbi who is giving the hashgacha is not going to give a hashgacha to that pizza parlor unless it uses Kemach Yoshan. So you now are a modern Orthodox Jew who's forced to have pizza that's Kemach Yoshan. And you now observe Kemach Yoshan, at least when you're eating out, not at home. Sort of the reverse of what kosher happens. I eat glatt outside, but at home, just plain kosher. Those are the kinds of changes that have slowly been taking place. The institutions of orthodoxy have increasingly become the domain of people who are significantly to the right of this contrapuntalist orthodoxy. So that's the second element here. That is that many of the institutions to which the Orthodox Jews are attached, and it's much more important than pizza parlors. We're talking about educational institutions. Who are the educators in many of these institutions? The yeshivas, including the day schools, because in day schools, who became the Torah educators? Most of the modern Orthodox did not go into Jewish education. Many of those children who the parents sent to Harvard, Yale, University of Pennsylvania, University wherever, didn't come home and say, Mom and Dad, Abba, Ima, I've decided to become a Jewish educator. Because if they would have done that, the parents would have said, where did I go wrong? I spent all this money for this education, and now this person, my son or daughter, wants to teach in a day school? At least be a principal. Okay, so as a result, the people who became those educators were people who did devote themselves wholeheartedly to chinuch, who did feel that Jewish education was the primary goal, but many of them believed that the best place for them to earn a parnasa and a living was in the world where the salaries were at least a little bit higher than they are in many of those smaller yeshivas. So they found their way into the day schools as well as the yeshivas. And I know Marvin thinks I'm nuts in saying this, but in fact, they have had a profound impact on their students. In part, because what we find is what has been true in general in Jewish education in America, that each of the movements, it turns out, gets an educator who's one click to the right of the students who are in that institution. So many of the educators in these places did not necessarily share the contrapuntalist view, even if the institution itself did, of the parents and somehow the children who went there. Without going into all of those details, we can talk about that perhaps in a question and answer or later, I imagine we'll talk about it on the panel. But in fact, the result was that many of the messages, both given and given off, and I think we need to understand that an educator in Jewish education is not just about pedagogy. It's not just about learning skills. If it were, it would be something quite different. But Jewish pedagogy is also about a way of life, about role models, about world views. You know, one of the best kept secrets, or maybe worst kept secrets, in Jewish education, when I went to day school in the previous century, we came out knowing how to speak modern Hebrew. Because that was part of the sort of Zionist value of those institutions. Now, those institutions still have Zionist values, but most of the kids who come out of a day school education today don't speak modern Hebrew anymore because that Haredi model of teaching, whether it's Gemara or Chumash or Nach or whatever, Ivrit be'Ivrit, is gone. It was not part of that outlook of the world. In fact, even the kind of Hebrew spoken, I live in Westchester County. There's a number of young men in my community who grew up in Westchester County, but when they daven Hebrew, they sound like they came from Lithuania. They look like they came from Lithuania. There's a young man in my community, his first name is Eitan, I'm not going to tell you his last name, and he goes to Lakewood. And his Rebbe asked him, Eitan, what's your Hebrew name? It's not a joke. It's the truth. The second has been, so we have this perceived decline of American culture, the gradual takeover of Jewish education and rabbinic training. It's not just the Jewish educator, of course, it's the rabbis as well, who have embraced a world that is enclavist, largely enclavist. A related issue is the handover of Jewish education completely to the schools. I mean, the Orthodox world built day schools and yeshivas while parents became otherwise engaged, most in dual careers. And so they handed over the education, the religious education, to the people in the school and to some extent to the rabbis in the synagogues. And when those rabbis and educators didn't share their worldview, they were sort of stuck because they couldn't say ignore the teachers because they hired the teachers. The teachers represented them. They couldn't say ignore what the Rebbe says, although some young people did learn that lesson. The message was given off, and many of them, when they went to college, they took the first opportunity to reject and rebel against that way of life. But the others, there were, again, this kind of polarization. Some came out of day schools and they left the Jewish world, but others came out and they did change, they did rebel, but they moved in the other direction. A third important element, of course, has been the change in America moving to the right, the great religious awakening. It is appropriate in America now, it is acceptable in America now to be very publicly ethnic and religious and traditional. I teach in a public university. I have students who are completely veiled. I'm not even sure the student who takes the exam is the same student who was sitting in the exam. All I see is her eyes. I have students who won't take an exam on Eid al-Fitr. I have students, of course, who won't come to my school is mostly closed on the Yom Tovim because I teach in New York. But by and large, I have students who are frum, and I have students who are from Muslims, and I have students who are from Christians. There is a gradual, there's been this, what sometimes is called the third great religious awakening in America, that has given a kind of self-confidence to movements on the religious right, and in that environment, a move to the right is also possible, this polarization in America. And finally, there's been a final factor, I think, that has led to the increased sense in the Orthodox community that only in the enclave can they be safe. And that has turned many suburbs into shtetls. It has turned many Orthodox communities that started out in a somewhat cosmopolitan character becoming more and more parochial, more and more enclavist. But in many ways, many parents, when their children came out of high school, were not persuaded that they were yet ready to encounter the outside world. And so there has arisen in the contrapuntalist world something that already existed in the enclavist world, and that is the idea of spending some time just learning Torah. And it was in many ways associated with Zionism, the Zionism of the modern Orthodox contrapuntalist world, and that was the year in Israel. Now, what is the year in Israel? As I often tell audiences, if you think the university is an ivory tower, you've never been to a yeshiva in Israel. A yeshiva in Israel is the true ivory tower. Most of the people who go to that yeshiva from day schools have already gotten into college, so they don't have to worry about grades. There are no grades in the yeshiva. the only need that they have is to sit and learn, to follow the Seder from the morning to the evening with their ramim in the room, to have a chavrusa. There is, the only pressure is, in a sense, to learn. And these are young people, many of whom have left home for the first time. They've left home. They're at a period of time when it is an issue for every young person at around that age to separate from their families. Separating meaning to establish a new identity. That's the age of rebellion. How do you rebel in a yeshiva? How do you separate from your parents in a yeshiva? How can you rebel when you're Orthodox? You can do it in a very fundamental way. I should say fundamentalist, but I'm afraid of saying that. But you can do it in a very fundamental way. You become more frum than your parents, because then they can say nothing. You've put them in a place where you can demonstrate that you're not as duplicitous as they are. You don't lead this kind of compartmentalized contrapuntal life with all of those distinctions. You are pure, you are real, you are dedicated. Moreover, everyone in the yeshiva is telling you, from the Rosh Yeshiva down to your chavrusa, that you are a noble prince or princess, that you are doing what God created you to do, that you are learning Torah, and that's why you were put on this earth. It's everything that you've been taught to do. And what is the goal of Shana Aleph in the yeshiva? Shana Bet. And what is the goal of Shana Bet? Shana Gimel. And what is the goal of Shana Gimel? The goal is never to leave that world, because if you do leave that world, you are guilty. Guilty is charged, you've gone back. Now, you got into Harvard, you've been in the yeshiva for 2-3 years. Are you going to go back to Harvard? Maybe Harvard. As someone said, you know, for a gorgel, it doesn't pay to become fleshik, but for a polka, yes. So maybe Harvard you go back to, but certainly not to the University of Pennsylvania or Columbia. Instead, go back, if you have to go back, to Yeshiva College, where you can get through in 2 years, because they'll give you credit for the yeshiva years, or maybe to a public college. You get through it without being touched by it. Take only the courses you need for a parnasa. Certainly don't take Sociology 101 with Heilman. Stay away from those kinds of courses and get through it as well as possible. But when you come back, you have left the noble sanctuary. And in order, as we all know, when you come back, you want to show that even though I came back, I didn't sell out. So you can find these young men and women, they start coming to shul, and they daven Shmona Esrei much longer than anyone else. You can see them coming in the morning, the parents sort of dragging behind them because the father's not used to coming to Minyan so many times during the week. The kid is wearing black. He's pumping and davening at the Amud. He's learning. He's steiging. He's doing all the things that demonstrate that even though I'm in this world of the contrapuntalists, I'm not of this world of the contrapuntalists. I still live in the yeshiva. I still belong to the yeshiva. I still am attached. I'm not going to become like you. You're not going to bring me back to this world. Now, time has passed, and many of these young men and women are already, they're in their late 20s, early 30s. They are now the ones who are hiring the rabbis, or are the rabbis. They are now the ones who are shaping the community. And the community that they're shaping and the orthodoxy to which they're attached is much more reflective of that kind of worldview which they have embraced. And slowly but surely, the enclave culture becomes characteristic of what was once a cosmopolitan and contrapuntalist world. And we see this in places like the Five Towns in Long Island. We see it in, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure you've seen it in lots of places. So those have been sort of the factors. Let me just sort of quickly jump to my last point, because I see I'm out of time, and that is, where does this all lead? Well, you know, we can always talk about pendulums, and there's no question that a pendulum is swinging, and even the most tightly controlled enclaves, as we've seen, whether it's Lakewood or somewhere else, the outside world seeps in, whether it's electronically or culturally. You cannot help but rubbing shoulders with people who are not so comfortable. And I think that what we can think about is a postmodern orthodoxy, where there is a blurring of boundaries, where people are beginning to choose not only either-or options, which have been so much a part of the enclavist world. And I have a chapter in my book called Machon LeParnasa about people from the Haredi world who have come to an institution that happens to be in Borough Park, that's actually a part of Touro College, in order to sort of get a second chance, realizing that some of the skills that they lack, they could get and could change perhaps some of their way of life. So there's a blurring of boundaries, and I think in the post-modern orthodoxy, there is a kind of both-and world where you can be, as Rabbi Studen described himself, moderate Haredi, and I joked with him on the plane over, underneath his beard, he's clean-shaven. He is completely, don't always judge what someone looks like. You can wear a black hat on the weekends and during the rest of the week be quite different. There are mixtures within families and communities, as we all know. There is an economic and institutional interdependence. And even if the contest goes on, as it is going on, over who best represents orthodoxy and who gets to speak for orthodoxy and who defines orthodoxy and who is best making the future of orthodoxy assured, each member has the potential to stand for the whole. And as I said, from the distance, these great differences within Orthodoxy turn out to be small and trivial. William James once noted that when we conceptualize, we cut and fix and exclude anything but what we have fixed, whereas in the real, concrete, sensible flux of life experiences, things co-penetrate one another. That is, reality strives for diversification. The postmodern view is suspicious of authoritative definitions and singular narratives of any trajectory of events. It recognizes that America is a country that invents and reinvents itself again and again with each new wave of immigration, with each new generation. American Jews, as we know, have reinvented themselves, particularly when they've become overwhelmingly native-born. The Baba Vareba is native-born, right? The Satmar Rebbe is a native-born American, whoever he happens to be, whether he's one or the other. America is part of this reality. And so there is reason to suppose that Orthodox Jews in America will also reinvent themselves and their movement again and again, generation after generation. And a postmodern Orthodoxy may be contingent and temporary and may refuse to make claims to any single truth or grand scheme for living as an Orthodox Jew. Today, frum leads to frummer. But tomorrow, who knows?
Thank you so much. We have time for a few questions.
Pardon me, sir.
So he's going to decide who
has the question. In your presentation, one striking element you did not deal with, that's the question of Parnassa, particularly in the enclave community. And doesn't this have a profound influence on the direction?
Absolutely. I mentioned it just in passing when in talking about the chapter of the Machon LeParnassa. The question is, does Parnassa have an impact? And there's no doubt that it does. I'm sure that all of the money collectors who come to your shuls and your doors tend, by and large, to come from institutions to the right. They come to your door because the reform and the conservative and the reconstructionist Jews are not likely to be forthcoming with funds for them. That means that in some ways they're dependent upon somebody within the community in supporting them and sustaining them. Now in America, much of this support comes in a variety of ways. It comes from the government for AIDS for dependent children. It comes in subsidies for pregnant mothers. It comes in housing subsidies. It comes in the school lunch program. So funding is an important part of it. And we know, for example, in Kiryas Yoel, we don't know a lot about the economics of the Haredi community, in part because you can't ask about religion in America, and you certainly can't ask about questions that would distinguish about religion in the census. But Kiryas Yoel, which is a Satmar enclave in upstate New York, is an incorporated village in the state of New York. So you can look at things in the census there. And if you look at white non-Hispanics, who are 99.1% of Kiryas Yoel, the other are the help, if you look at them, they are 62% below, 62% of that population is below the poverty level. Same thing in New Square. Same thing in Kesar, which is Vizhnitz. So we have some sense, and we can look in Williamsburg, we have some sense of the economic consequences of this way of life. Not everybody goes into poverty, but if you have lots of children, if you have people who are not always gainfully employed, who are spending time learning, and the Torah without the Kemach, clearly you're going to have some economic consequences. Now, why haven't these economic consequences hit so far? Part of it is that we've been living in the post-war period in extraordinary economic boom times. Money has been plentiful, and in part it has, the Orthodox are the poorest of all Jews in America per capita, Orthodox Jews have been making more money all along. They spend an enormous amount of money on their Jewish bill, as we know, but there is more money around, in addition to which many people, I remember once, this sort of gives you one hint about where some of this money comes from. On Chol HaMoed Sukkos, I was in a Hasidic yeshiva, and someone turned to me, and there was two Hasidim who were talking, and they were looking for somebody who writes on Chol HaMoed. So they looked at me, and they said, "You must write on Chol HaMoed." So I said, "Yeah, as it happens, I do." So one chassid wanted to write down something that the other chassid had told him, some address. So he pulled out from his wallet a card that I should write on it what he tells me. I noticed that the card was his E-Trade broker. So that told me that this chassid, whatever else he's doing, is very much connected and making, in some ways, knows about the investment world. Obviously, he's investing online, so somehow he has an internet connection. So clearly, there have been ways in which this world is supporting and sustaining itself. But the question you ask is the $64 question, which is, can it continue to sustain its way of life? This way of life requires a lot of income somewhere. And we don't know what the future will bring. Where's the mic man? Okay.
You mentioned that often a number of students, young people, are going to spend a year or so in Israel before they go to the university. My question is, does this help Israeli advocacy in the universities these days when there is so much anti-Israeli sentiment?
The short answer is no, because many of these kids decide not to go to the universities when they come back, or they go to universities and live within a very closed group. Occasionally it does. For example, I think the controversy at Columbia over free speech and the Palestinian, pro-Palestinian orientation of some of the professors there was reacted to by young men and women, many of whom had been in the kind of yeshiva environment in Israel before, but New York is a very specialized kind of environment. But by and large, these are not young men and women who choose to go back to the university and become advocates of Israel. In fact, one of the characteristics of many of these yeshivas, some of them are Hesder yeshivas, but even in the Hesder yeshivas, there's been a chardalization of life. And many of them, I mean, if you've been to the Mir Yeshiva, you're not coming back to argue for Zionism. That's not what you have learned to do in the Mir Yeshiva. So, and Mir is one of the elite institutions that some of these kids go to. So, by and large, they don't come back as spokesmen for Israel.
Can you just speak maybe to the specialized enclavist communities that on purpose open aggressive windows to the contrapuntalists among us, the ones specifically, obviously I'm talking about the Baal Tshuva.
You mean like Chabad?
Well, Chabad, Eish, or Sameach, the ones that are happy to approach all Jews, including modern Orthodox Jews, to...
Right. So that's an excellent question. What about those outreach? We might call it Haredi outreach. So you know that if we take those institutions that you mentioned, let's take Chabad as an example. Chabad represents for many in the Haredi world a very dangerous phenomenon because they, a Baal Tshuva is a little bit like the red heifer. It's Metaher Tameim and Metame Tahorim. It has the problem of when you bring a Baal Tshuva into the community, that Baal Tshuva brings a whole bunch of baggage, including their parents, including their history. And so, by and large, in many of these worlds, they marry a Baal Tshuva to a Baal Tshuva. The Baal Tshuva is, by and large, viewed as a producer of an FFB, of a from birth. So what happens in many of these communities is that the children become the key anchor. Many of the Baal Tshuva may, you know, there is an attitude about Baalei Tshuva within the Orthodox world, which is a love-hate relationship, an ambivalence about them. Why would you choose this way of life? You were out. Why would you come in? You were free. Why did you come in? So there's a doubt. If you came in so fast, you might go out so fast. We are anchored. We're not about to move. But once the children are in, the anchor seems more deeply embedded. So part of that is this effort to create a second generation. And also, you have to admit, one of the most extraordinary things about a Chabad Shaliach is that a Chabad Shaliach who's in, I don't know whether it's Edmonton or Madison, Wisconsin, or wherever he is, they usually go as couples, they send their children back to the community. But what they do in these communities is extraordinarily flexible. They are Haredi Jews who are acting more modern than modern Orthodox Jews. You can drive to a Chabad shul. They're not going to throw you out because you drove on Shabbos. They're going to try to convince you not. But if they threw out everybody who drove on Shabbos, they might not have a minyan in some places. So they are going to be doing things that are much more flexible. And this, I think, is an illustration of how ambiguous the spectrum is. If you're a Chabad Chassid or an Eish representative or one of those people, and you're trying to bring others in, you have to be much more tolerant, much more pluralist. You can't outcast. You can't view them as defiling. And then you begin to wonder whether the tail is wagging the dog. At a certain point, it's hard to figure out if this Chabad Shaliach is acting in such a flexible and open way in Madison, Wisconsin. How come he closes his eyes when he comes to Crown Heights? And as it turns out, he doesn't come to Crown Heights anymore. I just received an email. The latest gathering of the Chabad Shluchim is, they said, we've outgrown Brooklyn. We've outgrown Manhattan. They're now in exile in Somerset, New Jersey, which is down near Philadelphia. That is an extraordinary turn of events. So it's not exactly what it seems at face value. Although, from the outside, oh my God, you got hit by Chabad. You must have gone off the deep end. And okay.